Think about your day so far. You probably checked the weather on your phone, maybe ordered some food or streamed some music. Well, most of these, incredibly seamless interactions, the ones often hidden under the hood, they're made possible by something you probably don't think much about, an API.
Welcome to this deep dive. We're going to try and unravel the concept of an application programming interface, or API.
Right.
At its core, really, an API is a connection point. It's for computers or computer programs to connect. It's a type of software interface, basically, that offers services to other pieces of software. It lets them talk.
Okay.
And crucially, it's not like a user interface, you know, the screen you tap on your phone. It's designed specifically for machines or maybe programmers to communicate with each other.
Gotcha. So our mission today is to kind of cut through the jargon, right? Demystify APIs for you, the curious learner.
Exactly.
We're going to look at their origins, which are surprisingly early, delve into the wildly different types that exist, understand the principles behind how they're designed and released, and even touch upon those fascinating legal battles that have shaped their very definition.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Prepare for some hopefully illuminating aha moments as we unpack this essential, often unseen building block of our digital world.
So when we talk about an API, the term itself can actually mean one of two things. It can be the specification, think of that like a blueprint or a detailed document saying how to build that connection or interface.
Right, the instructions.
Or it can refer to the implementation itself, the actual working computer system that meets that standard that follows the blueprint.
Ah, okay. So the term does double duty.
Pretty much. It can mean the instructions or the thing built from the instructions.
And that's really where that under the hood nature comes in, isn't it? Unlike a UI, a user interface, which is built for us, for people.
Yeah.
An API is all about machine-to-machine communication. It's not usually something you see. It's what lets two totally different software systems talk across a boundary using like a mutually agreed upon language.
Exactly. And what's really fascinating, I think, is how APIs achieve this abstraction and simplification. A core purpose is to hide the really complex internal details of how a system works. They expose only the bits that are useful and necessary for a programmer, keeping those external connections consistent, even if the internal machinery changes completely.
So it simplifies programming.
Immensely. Makes things far more manageable.
Okay, so if I'm getting this right, it's a bit like Lego bricks.
Oh, that's a good analogy, yeah.
Each software, service, or library is like a Lego brick, and its API is the specific pattern of studs and tubes that let it snap onto other bricks.
Perfect.
So you can join them together, integrate them to build new software without needing to know how each individual brick was actually molded inside.
That's a perfect way to put it, yeah. Or, to give you a more concrete example, imagine a weather sensor that offers an API.
Okay.
When a specific message is sent to that sensor, that's an API call, it goes and detects the current weather conditions and then replies with a weather report. That's the API response.
Oh.
Now, a weather forecasting app could integrate with loads of these sensor APIs from different places, different providers, gathering data from all over, all speaking that common API language.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
So an API is basically a digital contract then. An agreement between the service provider who offers the API and the developers who use it.
Yes, exactly. A contract is a great way to think about it.
And I guess if that API stays stable, or maybe only changes in really predictable ways, developers feel more confident, right? And they're more likely to build cool things with it.
Precisely. That trust, that stability, it's fundamental.
Okay.
And speaking of how things evolved, the basic idea of an API actually predates the term itself by... wow, quite a bit.
Wait, really? The idea goes back to the 1940s. That's amazing.
It is, isn't it? You had British computer scientists Maurice Wilkes and David Wheeler working on a modular software library for EDISAC, a very early computer, and they created what they call a library catalog of notes on subroutines. That catalog was, effectively, an early form of API specification. Joshua Block even credits them with latently inventing the API.
Latently inventing, what does that mean?
Well, it suggests it was more of a concept discovered through practice, through the need for modularity, rather than someone sitting down and saying, I shall invent the API today.
Okay, it emerged.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The actual term application program interface, notice, without the ing, first showed up in a 1968 paper about remote computer graphics.
Remote graphics in 68.
Yeah. The goal was to make hardware-independent programs possible. Imagine wanting to swap out your graphics display device An API let programmers write code that didn't need to know the specific quirks of every single piece of hardware. It created a layer of independence.
Creating that buffer, that separation.
Okay. Then, in the 70s, CJ Date brought the term into the world of databases. In a 74 paper, APIs became part of the ANSI Spark framework for database management systems. And what's interesting is that people back then observed that a really rich application interface could actually support other kinds of interfaces too, sort of hinting at its foundational nature.
So it was becoming more general.
Yeah, this broadening continued. By 1990, the technologist Carl Malamud offered a wonderfully simple definition. An API is just a set of services available to a programmer for performing certain tasks.
Just a set of services. Simple. So how did that simple idea pave the way for the remote and web APIs that, you know, basically run the internet today?
Well, that's where networking really kicked in. As computer networks became more common in the 70s and 80s, programmers realized they wanted to call libraries on other computers, not just their own.
Ah, right, across the network.
Exactly. This led to things called remote procedure calls, RPCs. Java actually supported these particularly well later on. Then in the 90s, with the internet explosion, you got standards like CORBA, COM, DCOM.
Yeah, I remember those acronyms.
They were all competing to be the universal way for software components to offer their services across networks. Kind of early, complex attempts at a universal language for software talking over distances.
But the real game changer for the modern web API, that came later, right?
Yeah.
With REST.
Absolutely. Roy Fielding's 2000 dissertation outlined representational state transfer, or REST. He described a network-based application programming interface and contrasted it sharply with those traditional, more local, library-based APIs.
Okay.
By the early 2000s, XML and then JSON web APIs saw huge commercial adoption. That's when web API became the most common meaning of the term, really.
And now it seems like it overlaps a lot with just communication protocol.
It does, yeah. It describes so much of the communication across the internet, enabling things like the semantic web where data itself is distributed and linked through these interfaces.
That history really shows how the API evolved from like simple library notes to the backbone of everything digital. So let's zoom in now on the different types of APIs out there today. They're not all the same, are they?
Not at all. There's incredible diversity. One fundamental type is the interface to software libraries and frameworks.
Okay.
Here, the API is the specification what the library should do. The library itself is the implementation, the actual code. And it's common for one API spec to have multiple implementations.
Right.
For instance, because Scala and Java both compile down to compatible bytecode, the language the computer understands, Scala developers can just use any Java API without any extra work.
That's neat. So language independence in action.
Yeah.
And the type of programming language itself influences the API you mentioned?
Definitely. A procedural language like Lua might have an API with simple routines for running code or handling data. An object-oriented language like Java, though, its API would specify classes and their methods a different structure entirely.
And this brings up something called Hiram's Law. What's that about?
Hiram's Law. It's a fascinating observation. It basically says, with a sufficient number of users of an API, it does not matter what you promise in the contract. All observable behaviors of your system will be depended on by somebody.
Okay, unpack that a bit.
It means, even if you didn't intend for a certain quirk or behavior in your API, if enough people start relying on it, you can't easily change it, even if it wasn't part of the official contract.
Wow. So even bugs can become features people depend on.
Sort of, yeah. It forces API designers to be incredibly careful about everything their API does, documented or not. Because once it's out there and widely used, changing anything is risky. It really highlights the responsibility involved.
Despite that, you said most apps only use a small part of an API.
Yeah, studies show that. Developers tend to focus on the core functionality they need. We also see things called language bindings APIs that let you use a library written in one language, say C++A, within a program written in another, like Python. Tools like Swig or F2PY act as translators.
Okay, translators between code languages. Fascinating. So that's APIs for libraries. Then we have operating system APIs.
Right. These specify the interface between an application program and the OS itself.
Like PubSecOps.
Exactly. PubSecOps is a great example. It defines common APIs, so you can write an application for one PubSecOps-compliant OS, like Linux, and then compile and run it on another, like a BSD system, without major changes. Portability is the goal.
And Microsoft with Windows, they went a different route, focusing on backward compatibility.
Very much so. Microsoft has shown a huge commitment to backward compatibility with its Windows API, Win32. That's why you can often run quite old applications on newer Windows versions using compatibility mode.
Yeah, that saved me a few times with old games.
Right. Though there was that historical debate about whether Microsoft's internal developers had an unfair advantage because they knew more about the unpublished parts of the API. One analyst in 87 used a baseball analogy. He said it was like Microsoft owns all the bats in the field. Though Bill Gates countered that their Mac apps were successful because they didn't have that internal OS knowledge and had to rely purely on the public APIs, just like everyone else.
Interesting perspective. Mm. And you mentioned a distinction between API and ABI.
Yeah, it's important. An API is about the source code, how programmers write code to talk to the system. An application binary interface, or ADI, is lower level. It's binary-based, defining how compiled programs interact directly with the OS or hardware without needing the original source code. Think PO6 API versus the Linux standard base API.
That's clear. So that covers local and OS interactions.
Yeah.
But what about when the software is far away, across the internet, maybe? That's where remote APIs come in.
Precisely. Remote APIs let developers manipulate resources that aren't on their local machine. They do this via protocols, and it doesn't usually matter what language or platform each end is using.
Examples.
Java database connectivity, JDBC. It lets you query different kinds of databases using the same standard functions. Or Java Remote Method Invocation, RMI, which cleverly makes functions running on a remote machine look like they're running locally to the developer.
Sneaky.
It's very useful, especially in object-oriented programming, for maintaining that illusion of local objects, even when they're distributed.
And finally, the type we probably hear about most these days, web APIs.
Definitely the most common usage of the term now. Web APIs are the interfaces for interaction between, say, an enterprise and the applications that use its data or services, often backed by service-level agreements or SLAs.
Okay.
They typically work over the web standard protocol, HTTP. You send an HTTP request message, and you get back a response message, usually formatted in XML or, more commonly now, JSON.
Like the shipping example.
Exactly. An e-commerce site calculating shipping costs by calling out to a shipping company's API in real time instead of managing complex rate tables itself.
And these have evolved too, right? From SOAP to REST.
Yeah, there was a big shift. SOAP-based web services were quite rigid and complex. REST-style web resources, which focus on the resources themselves, like a user profile or a product, are generally simpler and more flexible. It really fit the whole Web 2.0 trend of connecting everything.
And that interconnectivity, that led to mashups,
yeah.
Combining different APIs.
Absolutely. Mashups are a prime example. You take data or functionality from multiple web APIs, maybe maps from one, photos from another, reviews from a third, and combine them into a totally new application or service.
Like using the Twitter API to pull trends or data into another app.
Perfect example. Social media APIs really fueled the mashup culture. It's all about taking these building blocks and creating something new and innovative.
Okay, so we've got a good handle on what APIs are, their history, the different types. Let's talk about their life cycle, how they're designed, released, documented. What's key in API design?
Design is hugely important. It really impacts how usable and popular an API becomes. It's fundamentally about information hiding.
Hiding things.
Yeah, hiding the complex internal workings. You only expose the necessary tools and functions that a developer would logically need, keeping the implementation details safely tucked away behind that clean interface. Good API design is actually a crucial part of good software architecture.
Makes sense. Keep it simple on the outside. And once it's designed, how does it get out into the world, these release policies?
Right. APIs are super common for tech companies to integrate their systems, forming these business ecosystems. There are basically three main release policies.
Okay.
First, private APIs. These are strictly for internal use within a company. Nobody outside gets access.
Got it.
Then partner APIs. These are shared, but only with specific trusted business partners. Think of Uber or Lyft letting approved third-party apps request rides directly through an API. They maintain control, ensure quality, maybe generate revenue.
Right, a controlled sharing.
And finally, public APIs. These are open for general use, though not always completely free or unrestricted. Microsoft's Windows API, Apple's Cocoa framework for macOS and iOS, those are public.
But some public ones still need registration or something.
Yeah, exactly. Services like Cloudflare or Voxility might offer public APIs, but you often need an API key or maybe prove you're a customer to actually use them. It adds a layer of tracking and control.
Okay. And for these public APIs, stability must be incredibly important, right? You can't just change things willy-nilly.
Oh, absolutely critical. That's a huge responsibility. Unexpected changes can break compatibility for potentially thousands, even millions, of client applications relying on that API.
So how do they handle changes?
Well, if parts of an API are still under development or likely to change, they should be clearly marked as unstable. Google's Guava library uses an app beta annotation, which is like a big warning sign. Use this, but be aware it might change or disappear.
Okay.
Also, you have the concept of deprecation. Parts of an API can be marked as deprecated, which signals this is old, we plan to remove or change it soon, you should move to the newer alternative.
That's
It
fair.
gives developers time to adapt.
That seems fair. Now, you mentioned Hiram's Law earlier. Does that mean people use APIs in ways the designers never even imagined?
Oh, all the time. It's fascinating. Client code often finds really innovative, sometimes purely opportunistic ways to use an API that the original designers never foresaw. It's a testament to developer creativity.
But it also sounds like it could cause problems.
Or security risks. It definitely can. That creativity can sometimes exploit loopholes or rely on undocumented behavior, and security is a massive concern. Public APIs present a huge attack surface.
How big are we talking?
Well, Akamai published a report in 2020. They tracked attacks targeting API endpoints between late 2017 and late 2019. They saw 16.55 billion credential stuffing attacks trying stolen usernames and passwords against APIs.
Billion.
Yeah, and nearly half a billion of those specifically targeted financial services APIs. It's a major battleground for cybersecurity.
That's staggering. Okay, so given all that complexity and risk, documentation sounds absolutely essential, like the API's instruction manual.
It truly is. Good documentation is vital for both initial development and long-term maintenance. It needs to explain what services the API offers, exactly how to use them, details on classes, methods, code examples, maybe even the reasoning behind design choices, performance tips, the contract itself.
Where do you usually find this documentation?
Traditionally, in dedicated files generated by tools like JavaDoc for Java or PyDoc for Python. But increasingly, you also find crucial information scattered across blogs, Q&A sites like Stack Overflow, community forums. It's becoming more distributed.
Which must make it hard to keep updated, right?
That's a huge challenge. Keeping documentation accurate and up to date as the API evolves is hard work, and getting developers to actually read it carefully is another hurdle. Misunderstandings or outdated docs can definitely lead to bugs or security flaws.
Are there ways to make documentation better?
Yeah, there are efforts. Metadata, like Java annotations within the code itself, can enrich documentation automatically. And there's research into data-driven methods analyzing how developers actually use an API in real code to infer common patterns and even generate documentation or examples based on typical usage.
Very cool. Okay, so this incredibly important, complex technology. It even ended up at the heart of a massive legal battle, didn't it, over copyright?
Indeed, the big one, Oracle versus Google. It started way back in 2010. Oracle sued Google, claiming that Google's implementation of Java APIs in the Android operating system infringed on Oracle's copyrights because they didn't get a license.
Right. And the initial ruling was that APIs couldn't be copyrighted.
Yes, in 2012, Judge William Alsup ruled that APIs are fundamentally functional and not eligible for copyright protection in the US. He was concerned that allowing API copyright would stifle innovation and let companies copyright simple commands, basically locking down functional interfaces.
That wasn't the end of it.
Not by a long shot. That ruling was overturned on appeal in 2014. The appeals court said the structure could be copyrighted, but they sent it back down to figure out if Google's use was fair use, a legal exception to copyright.
Okay, so round two.
Round two in 2016, a jury actually found that Google's use was fair use.
Ah, so Google wins.
Not yet. Oracle appealed again, and in 2018, the Federal Circuit Court overturned the jury verdict, ruling it was not fair use.
Wow, this is like legal whiplash. So Oracle was winning at that point.
It looked that way. It was a major blow to Google and many in the software development world who rely on interoperability.
So what finally happened? How did it get resolved?
Google took the case all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States in 2019. There were some delays, partly due to the pandemic. But in April 2021, the Supreme Court finally delivered its decision. They ruled 6-2 in favor of Google.
In favor of Google. So what was the reasoning?
They focused specifically on the fair use aspect. The court determined that Google's copying of the Java API structure was indeed fair use, considering the functional nature of APIs and the public benefit of software interoperability and innovation that Google's use enabled in creating Android. While they didn't definitively re-rule on the copyrightability question itself, the fair use finding effectively achieved a similar outcome for this specific crucial case.
A landmark decision, then.
Absolutely. Hugely significant for the software industry.
Okay, so you've just taken a deep dive with us into the world of APIs. We've seen they're not just technical acronyms, right? They're fundamental connections making our modern digital lives possible.
Yeah, from those unexpected origins in early computer libraries to powering the web today and even shaping major legal precedents, APIs are truly everywhere, often working completely unseen.
It's this hidden infrastructure that allows for just incredible innovation, all that connectivity, the efficiency we see across countless apps and services you use every single day.
Mm-hmm. It seamlessly links all these different systems together, often creating experiences that just wouldn't be possible otherwise.
So, thinking about that Supreme Court decision in Google v. Oracle, the ruling that Google's use of the Java API was fair use.
Mm.
What does that really unlock? What new opportunities might this create for software development, for interoperability?
That's the big question, isn't it?
And what responsibilities come with that increased freedom for developers to build upon existing interfaces? What could this mean for the future pace of innovation and how quickly new digital tools might come to life now? Something to think about.